Thank you all for coming. What a wonderfully impressive crowd. I'd like each of you, first of all, to ask yourself honestly the question why you came. Did you come to find out who's going to win? I hope not. Did you come to find out which arguments would win? That's a little better. Did you come to find out whether God would win, as if he's waiting in the wings with bated breath to find out whether he exists or not? I hope you came for the same reason that I came and the same reason my esteemed opponent came, namely to follow the argument to wherever it goes, out of respect for truth. If you're an agnostic, you wonder whether God exists. This might help you to decide. If you're a believer, you wonder how much reason can prove of what you believe. You might find out. If you're an atheist, you might find how much reason can prove for what you believe, because atheism is a faith too, even though it doesn't have a divine object. And I don't think it's any more provable than theism. Somebody is very seriously wrong. If there is no God, then between 95 and 98% of all human beings who have ever lived in the world have been seriously deluded. They've been like Jimmy Stewart in that old movie Harvey, who believes in this invisible rabbit as the most important person in his life. Nobody can see him but Jimmy Stewart. He's not there. He's nuts. In every other way, he's normal. But if there's no God, then Freud is right. Big Santa Claus, in which case humanity is pretty stupid. If, on the other hand, there is some sort of God and atheists are wrong, then it's the minority of atheists who are as out of touch with reality as you would be if you were a college student and came home for Christmas and your parents greeted you at the door and you pretended that they didn't exist and they gave you food and you didn't thank them for it and they gave you presents and you didn't even talk to them and you lived as if you were the only person in the world. So somebody is very seriously wrong. Whether God exists or not makes an enormous difference, because believers trust him with the meaning of their life and the destiny of their life, with everything. And if he doesn't exist, we're pouring an investment into a big black hole. Two preliminary questions. I don't claim to prove the existence of the God of the Bible, or everything the Bible reveals about God. If the Bible is a divine revelation, it's telling us stuff we couldn't find out by ourselves about God. Otherwise, it would be rather superfluous. I don't think that nothing about God is provable, but I don't think that everything about God is provable. I think that just some things about God are provable. And I'm not going to start with the definition of God and then prove that that being exists. That's how Anselm does it. I don't think that works. I think you have to have the meaning of God emerge from the data of each argument. The other preliminary point is that there are really five questions that we have to logically distinguish. First of all, whether a thing exists. It can exist without you knowing it. Secondly, whether you know it. You can know it without being certain of it. Thirdly, whether you can have certain knowledge of it. You can be certain without a proof of that certainty. Fourth, can you prove it? You can prove it without it being a scientific proof. Finally, is there a scientific proof, a proof by the scientific method? I think the first four of these questions can be answered yes. I think there are certain philosophical proofs for the existence of a being that has to be called God, even though they're not scientific proofs. In fact, I will summarize 12 arguments, maybe one a minute. Five very traditional cosmological arguments, the famous five ways of Aquinas, and then four psychological arguments, and then three practical arguments. Aquinas' first argument is the argument from motion, or change, to an unmoved mover, or an unchanged changer. He defines motion, or change, as the actualization of a potentiality. And he says nothing can change itself, because something that doesn't have some actual quality can't give that quality to something else that doesn't have it. For instance, this bottle of water can't get me wet unless it is already wet. And fire can't burn me unless it has kinetic energy to give. So if motion is a kind of active force, nothing moves itself. it has to be moved by another. But there is a chain of movers, moved movers. Is there a first unmoved mover? If not, how can you explain the existence of the chain? It's like who pushed down the first domino. That's a rather simple and intuitive proof. The second one is about the cause of existence. When you cause something to exist, you bring it into being for the first time. You don't just change it. Now, nothing can cause itself to exist because nothing can exist before it exists. But the cause has to exist before it can communicate existence to the effect. Now, we all exist. If existence passed down the chain of causes through parents and ancestors and through evolution and through everything from the Big Bang on, if that doesn't have a first cause, if the Big Bang has no Big Banger, then why do we get the gift of existence? Suppose there was some book that you wanted very much that could make all of philosophy totally clear, and I guaranteed you that you would get A's in all your courses if you had this book. You would say, give me the book. I would say, well, yes, but I have to borrow it first from my wife. Well, does she have it? No, she has to borrow it from her neighbor. Does she have it? No, she has to borrow it from the library. Well, does the library have it? No, they have to get it from interlibrary loan. From where? From a university? Do they have it? No. Actually, nobody has it. Oh, well, then you'll never get it. Well, existence is like that book. You get it. So since you get it, somebody must have it by nature, not just having to borrow it by being brought into existence. Which brings us to a third argument, the argument from contingency and necessity. Things are contingent. They don't have to exist. Every one of us is a great might not have been. If you're contingent, you're contingent on something. But if that something is itself contingent, then all the beings in the universe, which are great might not have beens, are like links in a chain, which are held up somehow. And this link is held up by that link, and that link is held up by another link. Well, what holds up the whole chain? Does it just hang there in the air? If there are a sufficient number of links, does it make sense that the chain can hang itself? No. Something must ground it. Something must explain the whole chain. Thus, there must be a non-contingent being, a being that exists eternally by necessity of its own nature, rather than contingently by receiving existence as a gift from something that causes it. A fourth argument is the argument from the degrees of perfection. We observe commonsensically, and we judge that one thing is more perfect than another in various ways. We make value judgments. Unless you are a subjectivist, you believe that those value judgments can be true. So one thing really is more perfect than another. But whenever you grade things by a standard, if that grading is true, the standard must be true. Therefore, there must be an absolute standard, and that standard must be absolute perfection. But if that's only a fiction, something that you created, then it's merely subjective, and there are no grounds for your value judgments. Therefore, there must be a really most perfect being, which is one of the definitions of God. A fifth argument is the argument from design, which unfortunately is, I think, argued about in a non-useful way by both sides of the intelligent design movement, as if religion is on one side and philosophy and science is on the other side. I want to argue it neither from a religious nor a scientific point of view, but simply a philosophical point of view. We see in the universe that things cooperate together to produce a good effect. We see that the universe is a system of interlocking causes. And we see that it doesn't happen simply by random chance. The universe is much more complicated than a book. You don't explain a book by an explosion in a print factory. So if there's design, there must be a mind. Design presupposes some sort of a designer. After our first moon rocket took off from Cape Kennedy in Florida, there were two scientists who were working on the project together. One was an atheist, the other was a theist. And the theist jokingly said, "Isn't it wonderful that our rocket will hit the moon simply by chance?" The atheist said, "What nonsense." And the theist said, "Well, yes, it is, isn't it? Well, we can design a rocket. Can we design a universe? How come the universe works?" later they were walking down the street and the atheist saw a picture in a store and said, what a beautiful picture. I wonder who painted it. The theist said, nobody. It just happened by chance. There are very sophisticated refinements to the notion of design and to the notion of chance or randomness, which make this argument much more complex than it seems. But it's probably the single most popular argument for the existence of God among so-called uneducated people. Almost all primitive people use some version of it. All these arguments are taken from objective data. Let's look at subjective data. Let's look at psychological data. Inner data, you might say. Augustine has an epistemological argument from the eternity of truth to the eternity of a mind. True ideas exist in minds. If some ideas are eternally true, must there not be an eternal mind for those ideas to reside in? You can see this argument more clearly, I think, if you look at the flip side of it in Jean-Paul Sartre, who argues that precisely because there is no God and therefore no eternal mind, there are no eternal truths. Obviously, there are some eternal truths, like 2 and 2 are 4, as distinct from temporal truths, such as we are here tonight. A second psychological argument is the moral argument. There are two versions of this. One is from the existence of an objective moral law or a law of human nature or a natural law to a lawgiver as the only adequate explanation of that law. And the second does not presuppose the existence of an objective and universal natural moral law, which was not doubted by very many thinkers in the past, but is quite doubted today. Cardinal Newman's version of the argument, which begins with the premise simply that there is one thing that even the moral relativist thinks is always wrong, to deliberately disobey your conscience. So there's at least one moral absolute. But what authority is behind that absolute? Why should conscience always be obeyed as if it is a prophet of Almighty God? If conscience is simply an evolutionary survival mechanism, if it's simply inherited animal instincts, if it's simply conformity to social forces that we unconsciously internalize by the unconscious mind, by the superego, if it's simply the voice of our parents resounding in our heads, why bow down to that as if it's infallible? And yet everyone says that it is always wrong to disobey your conscience. So if there's no divine voice behind conscience, why take it seriously? This can be a dangerous argument because it can lead in the opposite direction. It could lead someone to the conclusion, I shouldn't take my conscience seriously since there is no God. There's a third argument, which is hardly an argument at all. It's kind of a direct perception. But I noticed that very many people respond to this. In fact, I know personally 3 ex-atheists who were converted by this argument. The argument goes as follows. There is the music of Johann Sebastian Bach, therefore there must be a God. You either see that or you don't. A fourth psychological argument, a very interesting one, is associated with C.S. Lewis. It's the argument from desire. We can classify our desires into 2 categories. Some of them are artificial and conditioned by advertising or what books we've read, and these are not universal. They're not cross-cultural. They don't come from human nature. They come from outside forces. Other desires are universal because they come from human nature itself, like hunger or thirst or sexual desire or curiosity or the desire for beauty. We have an innate aversion to ignorance and ugliness and hunger. But we have an innate desire for knowledge and friendship and beauty, certain things that fit our human nature. We observe that every one of these natural desires or innate desires corresponds to an objective reality. Where there is a hunger, there is a food. You might not get the food, you might starve, but it would be very strange if hunger occurred in a species that didn't have stomachs. Or if sexual desire occurred in a species without sex. Now, there is an unconscious desire, which most of us can recognize, for something more than we have ever experienced in this world. A desire for perfection, for perfect joy, perfect beauty, something that we can't quite fully define, because when we try to define it, it collapses, and we try to make a picture of either an otherworldly heaven or this worldly utopia, it turns out to be kind of boring. And yet we desire something more than we can conceive. Well, that's almost the definition of God. Eye has not seen, ear has not heard, nor has it entered into the heart of man the things God has prepared for those who love him. So either the general principle is wrong, that desire bespeaks the existence of its object, or we're being fooled, because the principle is correct in all other cases, but not this one. In which case, life is intelligently designed, but by a malevolent being who lures us with all these appetizers, and then when we die, we find that there's no God after all, and there's no main course, and we just fall into nothingness. Unless our desire is a meaningless trick, it's a kind of roadmap. And if you follow your heart as well as your head, you will be led to something very much like God. Finally, three human or practical arguments. One of them is the one I mentioned already. I call it the insanity argument. If atheism is true, most of the human race is insane. This is not a demonstration. It's not a proof. It just shows the price you must pay to deny that God exists. The price you must pay is that you must be something of a snob. You must believe that you, one of the few, maybe 5% of the human race, are the only sane ones, and that the rest of ordinary people are strictly insane. A somewhat similar argument is the argument from the saints. Are they insane? Those who believe in God the most, who are the most certain of God, who trust their lives most entirely to God, who let God direct their lives, are they the biggest fools in the world? If God doesn't exist, they are. Well, in that case, the human heart is very badly designed, because the more you follow your intellect, the more you'll become an atheist, and therefore the more you'll have to stifle your heart's deepest desire and your desire for an objective foundation of real goodness. That foundation could at best be a kind of Platonic form, an abstract category, but not a real person. Is the human heart that badly split? So badly that the smarter you are, the less seriously you'll take the good. And the more saintly you are, the more deceived you are. You could focus that question most extremely on Jesus, who, even by the non-Christian standards, was a saintly man, a wise man, a good man. If he's the best and wisest man who ever lived, and if he's also the one who relied on God, whom he called his father, the most, then the wiser you are, the stupider you are. The wiser you are morally, the stupider you are philosophically. As I said, that's not a demonstration, but the price you have to pay is trust in the integrity of your humanity. Finally, there's the last argument, which is not an argument for the existence of God at all. It's an argument for believing in God. It's Pascal's wager. It's basically, what are the consequences of belief and unbelief? If God exists and you believe in him, and if at least the Christian version of God is true, in which God gives you free will and respects it and waits for you to accept his gift of himself, since a gift has to be freely accepted as well as freely given, otherwise it's not a gift. In that case, the way to get this thing that your heart desires the most of all is to accept the gift by faith, in believing. Now, even if you can't prove that God exists, that's a pretty good investment if you don't have to give up much for it. In fact, you have to give up nothing for it. On the other hand, if God exists and you don't believe in him, you've lost everything. You've lost eternal joy for no reason at all. And finally, if God doesn't exist, then it doesn't make any difference whether you believe in him or not, because there's no life after death and you'll never know. If there were two lottery tickets on this table, one of them was worth $1 million and the other was worth absolutely nothing, and you couldn't prove which one was the real one, and I offered you the chance of buying one of those two tickets sight unseen for a penny, or even $10, Would it be worth your while to make the bet? Well, of course. Well, isn't some rudimentary faith at least the world's best practical bet? Especially since the payoff is eternal. But even in this life, Pascal goes on to say in The Wager, even in this life is a payoff. Psychiatrists, who contain a very large percentage of atheists, routinely recommend religion to their patients because they see it makes them happier, it makes them well-adjusted, it makes them live better lives, and it makes them live longer. Once again, why can the human heart be so badly designed so that it's illusion that we need the most to make us all the other things that we want? So in defending God, I think I'm also defending humanity. And I've done it in less than 20 minutes.
Thank you, Dr. Kraft. We now invite Dr. Corsi to present his case.
Is this working? Okay. First, I thought to start with some characterization of what God is said to be by many theists, if not all theists. And arguing for atheism is something of like trying to hit a moving target, because even different Christians, I think, have different conceptions of what God is. When you get down to the details, they agree on the generalities, but there may be various disagreements about the details. And some of the arguments that I present then may be relevant to some conceptions, but not others. And I'll try to point those out. But it seems that the most common conception of God, or at least some of the characteristics many Christians ascribe to, include God's being the greatest possible being, by his nature being all-powerful, all-knowing, perfectly good, trustworthy, a creator of the universe, worthy of praise and complete devotion, a being that can't be destroyed, a being that's perfectly loving, a being that can freely choose to answer prayers, and so forth. Does that seem in the right direction? More or less? Okay, good. Sorry, I'm at the right place. Okay, I'm going to present a few different arguments that a being with these characteristics does not exist. And the first one I'm going to present is a variation on what's known as the problem of evil. And the first thing to note here, I think, is that there we can probably agree that there are terrible things that happen in the world. Most recently, the earthquake in Haiti was a horrible disaster. Apparently, hundreds of thousands of people have died, and considerably more have suffered, have lost loved ones, have lost friends, have lost limbs. A terrible catastrophe. At least we have a strong response to this situation. I'm sure many of you belong to groups that have delivered help to Haiti and help to the people in Haiti to help keep them from the suffering to continue to try to prevent that, to provide food and water to the people who need it, to provide medicine to the people who need it. We recognize, if you've been there, you've probably found come across a couple of people who have been unhurt. And we hear stories about that, and we think that they're very fortunate for not having lost friends and loved ones in their homes. These kinds of terrible things, I think we all recognize are terrible. Philosophers have a name for them. They call them natural evils. There are things that are bad that occur, but not due directly from human action. And in fact, the world contains quite a few different kinds of evils like these. There are natural disasters or accidents beyond earthquakes. There's floods and fires caused by lightning. People get hit by lightning, which result in all kinds of harm and suffering to people and to other creatures. There are threats from animals and insects to each other and to us. There are diseases, things like leprosy and cancer and pneumonia and schizophrenia, that do terrible harm to people. There are genetic defects such as blindness, children born without limbs, children born with severe deformities. And I think we can recognize that these are bad things. At the same time, of course, some good will come out of these things, right? For example, the good of providing help to those people that need it in Haiti is certainly a great good. But I don't think any of us really thinks that those kinds of goods outweigh the harm. I doubt few of us thought when we heard of the tragedy in Haiti that, oh, isn't this great? The world's going to be so much better now, right? That would be a very unusual response to that sort of situation. It would almost be an inhuman response, I think. For almost any good that comes out of these events, presumably not only can we help a little bit, but God could help a little bit if he chose to. It would be within God's power, simply by snapping his fingers, I suppose, to prevent all the harm and suffering that occurred in Haiti, or to prevent leprosy or cancer or pneumonia or what have you. These evils are sometimes thought of as pointless evils or unnecessary evils, as philosophers sometimes call them. An evil is pointless if either A, no good great enough to outweigh the evil follows from the evil, or B, God could create that good, he could get that good without the evil. Those evils are said to be pointless because they're not outweighed by any good that God couldn't otherwise get. Okay. Another thing I'd like to note is that we judge claims people make when they claim to represent the Word of God in terms of our own moral standards. Okay. When a person claims, for example, that they shouldn't be punished for having taken their AK-47 into a shopping mall and killing everyone they can find because God told them to, we are, I think, unlikely to believe their claims. We're likely to say, no, that probably wasn't God. It's more likely you're mentally ill. And the reason, I think, is that we recognize if God is a perfectly good and perfectly loving being, he wouldn't instruct someone to do that sort of thing. When people claim that it was God's will that planes flew into the World Trade Center, crowded with people, killing thousands, I think we're inclined to look at that situation and say, no, you've got to be mistaken about that. God wouldn't want you to do something like that. When Pat Robertson claimed that the people of Haiti deserve to die in an earthquake because their ancestors 200 years ago made a deal with a devil, I think most of us recognize that he's a nut. I mean, after all, 96% of the people in Haiti are Christian. Much higher percentage than in the United States. Imagine, and again, these are all examples of where we use our moral standards to make a judgment about what someone has claimed about God, right? Imagine that you have lived the perfect saintly Christian life, and you have done all the things that you sincerely thought God wanted you to do. And when you die, you get to meet God. And God, as it turns out, is red and has horns. And he says, yeah, I promised you heaven for living such a saintly life, but I just flipped this coin, and consequently, I think I'm going to send you to hell, because that would be most entertaining. I think the response you'd have is, well, you weren't quite who I thought you were, right? A being like that couldn't be God, because a being like that wouldn't do that sort of thing. The problem of evil is built on these very kinds of commonsensical accounts, judgments that we have, moral judgments about what people believe. Okay? The basic idea of the problem of evil goes like this. Suppose I'm walking down a path in the middle of winter, and there's a snow-covered ground, and there's no one else for miles around except a young child. And this young child, excuse me, I'm going to get a drink here, is playing on a frozen pond. Please don't mind the soda. I'm notorious for this, as my students will tell you. And I see that the child is, the ice is broken, the child has slipped into the pond and is drowning. And if I do nothing, if I just keep walking on, the child will die, right? We could suppose the situation is such that there's absolutely no risk to me. All I would have to do, I wouldn't even have to break stride, okay? All I'd have to do is I'm walking along, pick up the kid, throw him over there, see you later, kid, and he's safe. But suppose I say, I don't feel like doing that, and so I don't. What sort of person would I be? Would I be the most perfect being you could imagine? I'm probably a long way from that. But the thought of the problem of evil is that God is to us essentially as I would have been to the child, which is to say he could easily and without great harm to us save us from all kinds of harms that occur. But he doesn't bother to do so. And then the thought is, well, you know, I mean, he would have the power to do this. He's all-powerful. He'd have the knowledge to do this. He's all-knowing. He'd have the desire to do this because he's perfectly good. So why do these things occur? So in short, the argument goes like this. Put it in premise-conclusion form, right? As philosophers like to do. Premise one, God would prevent the occurrence of any pointless natural evils. Premise two, there exist instances of pointless natural evils. Therefore, conclusion, there does not exist an omnipotent, omniscient, holy good being, namely God. How do we know that there are pointless evils? Well, I've listed a few. You can probably easily imagine some. I'll give you one more example, famous example. Suppose in an unpopulated area, a bolt of lightning strikes and starts a fire. And in this fire is trapped a small fawn. We'll call her Bambi. And Bambi does not die immediately from smoke inhalation as you might, well, in that circumstance, I guess, hope. She gets burned horribly and lingers on for several days in agony before finally expiring as other animals eat her alive. Right? These things happen, right? We know they happen. Presumably, if there were a perfectly good God, there wouldn't, right? Because whatever good comes of Bambi lingering on in agony, presumably God could figure out a way to get that good without treating Bambi like that. And that's the argument regarding evil. Another argument for atheism is sometimes referred to as the argument from divine hiddenness. And the idea here is that there can't be or isn't, there's good evidence that there isn't, a perfectly loving, all-powerful, all-knowing being. Since God is said to be perfectly loving, if he exists, he would presumably desire to have a relationship with every human capable of such a relationship. This is a common theme in many Christian views, perhaps not all of them, but many of them, certainly not deism, but some Christian views. On many views, being perfectly loving means God has a desire to relate to his creatures. He wants creatures to have a relationship with him if they're ready to do so. Okay? To have such a relationship, it would have to be the case that a person has heard of God. Certainly no one could have not heard of God and have a relationship with him. Right? Certainly not a personal relationship anyway. So it would seem that God, if he's perfectly loving, would desire that every ready human has heard of him. So God would make it the case that every human ready to have a relationship with God will at least have heard of him. But throughout history, many people, through no fault of their own, have never heard of God. Individuals living in remote areas of the Amazon rainforest 1,000 years ago would never heard of God. People living in the Far East up through the Middle Ages would have never heard of the Christian God. Quite a number of individuals probably today have never heard of God. But if that's the case, then it would seem that there is no perfectly loving, all-powerful, all-knowing being. Because if there were, that wouldn't happen. That's the argument from divine hiddenness. A third argument is that there can be no greatest possible being. Certainly there's no greatest number. For every number, there's a higher one, right? What makes up for greatness? Well, probably a lot of different things. Certainly being good. But if we were to rank goodness, it's going to be like a series of numbers. It could go on forever. A creature could always do one more good thing. A creature could always create one more good creature. A creature could always, make chocolate less fattening. There are all kinds of things that could still be done, however much has already been done. But then, just as there's no highest number, there's no greatest possible being. Hence, there is no God. Next, a few problems with the way that God is commonly characterized. And these, again, will be more addressed at more particular conceptions of God. They may not be relevant to the conception you personally have, but they might be for several. And even if they're not, they'll give you some of the ideas of some of the issues that come up when trying to understand what it means to say that a creature might be all-powerful or all-knowing or what have you. Some people say that to say that God is all-powerful is to say that he can do anything at all. Or to say that God is all-powerful is to say that he can do anything that a human can. But there are problems, I think, with this view. Either one. First of all, God can't do evil. Because if he's perfectly good, he can't be evil. If he were to do evil, he would cease to be God because he would cease to be perfectly good. Presumably, God can't sin. Can't act against his own nature. Because whatever he does, it'll be by virtue of his nature. Presumably, he can't make a lump of metal so big he cannot lift it. But we can do these things. So it seems that there are things that we can do that God cannot. And that's something that I think will have to be a part of any plausible conception of what it means for a creature to be all-powerful. And I think the most plausible move for a theist to say, and maybe this is what Dr. Creek will say, is that, well, you know, so what? I don't hold this view of being all-powerful, right? I grant that we can do things that God cannot. And I think that's the most sensible thing to do for a theist. People claim that God is deserving of praise for what he does. In fact, not only praise, but worship, a very powerful kind of praise. But if God is perfectly good, then presumably he must always do what is for the best. He can't do what is less than the best, because then he ceases to be perfectly good, which is to say he ceases to be God. But if he always has to do what is for the best, then he doesn't have a whole lot of choice in what he does. He's more like a robot, turning out perfect actions every time without any freedom to do otherwise. But a robot is not a creature that is deserving of praise because it can't help what it does. And we don't praise things in the sense of being worthy of worship that Christians, I think, have in mind for doing what they can't but help do. Again, could God freely answer prayers? Well, if he always has to do what is for the best, then he's going to answer the prayer or not, and it won't be out of some grace. It won't be out of some free choice. It'll be because it's the best thing to do, and that's what he has to do anyway. So it's not clear that he can freely answer prayers. When people say that God is all-knowing, sometimes they say, what they mean, they say, is that God knows everything that can be known. Or God knows everything that any human has known. But I think these accounts are problematic. God can't know what it is like for him to permanently die. Because he can't die because he's eternal. He can't experience himself doing evil or being a sinner, or being crushed to death by an anvil, or discovering something about the past that he did not know. But we can do all these things. So it seems this account of being all-knowing is mistaken. Some say God has foreknowledge of all human actions, but then claim that people can be held responsible for what they do. I think this view is mistaken as well. It's called the problem of free will and divine foreknowledge. Okay? If people have free will, that means at least, presumably, they could have done otherwise. If God knows everything you're going to do, then he knew you would be here tonight sitting in the chair that you're sitting in. Suppose you had sat in another chair. You would have killed God because you would have proven God made a mistake, that God got it wrong. I don't think you can do that. But then it follows you had to sit in the chair you're going to sit in because otherwise God ceases to exist. But then you've got no free will. And if you've got no free will, the whole notion of holding people responsible, of judging them as to whether or not they should go to heaven or hell or prison or not, makes no sense whatsoever. Now, you can in part get around these problems by narrowing down your conception of being all-powerful, all-knowing, and perfectly good. The question is, once you've done that, once you've whittled away at these notions, is there anything left that's really a God? Is there a being that's worthy of worship? Is there a being that is still perfect, or is it less than perfect? And that's a difficult question, I think, for a theist to answer. I'm out of time, so I'll stop there.
Starting with him, huh? Thank you, Dr. Corsi. And now each of the debaters will have an opportunity to offer a rebuttal to one another, beginning again with Dr. Crave.
For throwing a lot of food on my plate. I did the same thing. Problem of evil has always been the atheist's big argument. In fact, it's the only argument that even seems to definitively refute the existence of God. So if I wanted to count, I could say 12 to 1, I beat you. But the logic doesn't work that way. There are two kinds of evil, as you said. There are natural evils or physical evils, which we suffer, like the earthquake in Haiti, and there are moral evils that we do. The more difficult kind of evil to explain, namely physical suffering, is the lesser evil. If your soul or your spirit or your personality is more important than your body, then to harm your soul is worse than to harm your body, although harming your body is still a bad thing. If I murder you, there's more evil in my soul than in your body. So the harder evil to explain, natural evil, is the less scandalous evil, the less evil evil. Sin is easy to explain. God gives you free will. If God is love, love always respects the freedom of the other person. Love does not force. Love does not rape. God is a gentleman. Even God cannot indeed do some things, and I'll answer this argument about divine omnipotence in connection with moral evil. Indeed, God can't do contradictions. They're meaningless. God cannot make a rock bigger than omnipotence can lift simply because that's a meaningless set of words. So I think you are tricked by language here. Yes, there are plenty of things that God can't do. They're all imperfections. He can't die. He can't sin. He can't discover new things. He can't make mathematical mistakes as we can. But that's because we're imperfect, not because we're perfect. There is no such thing as a rock bigger than omnipotence can lift. That's a meaningless set of self-contradictory concepts. And they don't suddenly become meaningful because you add the words God can do this or God cannot do this to them. Natural evils, though, remain a problem. And the main answer that theists have always given to natural evils is that they are consistent with the God hypothesis simply because of the attribute of omniscience. If God's the author and we're just a character in the play, we shouldn't expect to know why he does this or that. In other words, you are arguing that if God existed, then we should be able to know why he would do X or Y, why he would allow the earthquake in Haiti, and we don't. Therefore, God doesn't exist. I deny your major premise. I would say exactly the opposite. If God existed, we would not understand why he does most of the things he does, any more than our pets understand why we do what we do to them. Epicurus said, if there is a God, why is there evil? If there is no God, why is there good? The atheist has the problem of good to explain without God. The theist has the problem of evil to explain with God. But I ask, which is greater, good or evil? Ask the Haitians, who have just suffered horrendous natural evils. Look at the smiles on their faces. What is the poorest continent in the world? Africa. What is the continent that smiles the most? Africa. Compare Americans, the richest country in the world. How happy are we? How depressed are we? How many suicides are here? The suicide rate is directly proportionate to wealth in terms of nations and in terms of individuals. Would it be a better world if God miraculously prevented all human suffering? Obviously, if there's a God who can perform miracles, he can do that. Even the pagan Greeks knew that suffering teaches wisdom, and that without it, you become stupid and spoiled. As Rabbi Abraham Heschel famously said, the man who has not suffered, what could he possibly understand anyway? But there are three different challenges that you might have offered about the problem of natural evil or suffering. You might have said that any imperfection or natural evil disproves God, or too much of it disproves God, or the unjust distribution of it disproves God. The first doesn't seem to be true, because being what we are, we need some suffering to learn. But do we need that much? Well, apparently not, but how much is too much? Where can you draw the line? Would a Holocaust of 6 million disprove the existence of God, but not six? Would a cancer disprove God, but not a hemorrhoid? You can't draw a line. The serious question is the apparently unjust distribution of evil. Why does God let so-and-so suffer? That's the problem of Job. Why do bad things happen to good people? And once again, the clear answer of the book of Job is that we simply do not know. We can know general principles. We can know why it is not illogical to say that there is an omnibenevolent and omnipotent and omniscient God, and yet there are evils that we cannot explain. Those two facts are not logically contradictory. But we don't know individual details simply because, this may be news to some people, we're not God. Southern Baptist preacher once summarized the entire Bible in four words. He said, God's trying to get across to us just two things. One, I'm God. Two, you're not. We find the second the most difficult of the two. This is a rather mysterious answer, but it's the one given by classical Christian theism and the one given by the Bible, namely that natural evil is to be explained in some way in terms of moral evil. That, first of all, natural evil is necessary now to make us wise because we're morally evil and therefore stupid, but also that natural evil exists in the world because of moral evil. Somehow that story about Adam and Eve in the garden, however literally or non-literally you interpret it, seems to ring true of human nature if you accept the psychosomatic unity, the unity of body and soul. Because the evil of the soul, sin or moral evil, is inevitably going to have repercussions in the body. So that suffering is not so much a punishment for sin as a necessary consequence, like indigestion is a consequence of overeating. Just how that worked out in the cosmos, how the thorns and thistles and the pains in childbirth and in the sweat of thy brow thou shalt eat bread was an effect of the fall, I think cannot be explained scientifically or objectively. I think it has to be explained psychologically. I think if Adam bumped his toe on a rock before the fall, he just smiled and said to God, thanks, I needed that. But afterwards, it hurt pain is largely mental. You are right in emphasizing the character of God, because Christianity assumes that there is a God. It does not try to prove the existence of God. You find no proofs of the existence of God in the Bible. It assumes that if you don't know that God exists, you're a fool. But is God good? Is God trustable? That's not obvious. Apparently, God distributes evil in an arbitrary and unjust way. And faith or trust is necessary, as it is on the part of a pet towards a pet owner, to actually get you out of evil. If a dog is caught in a bear trap and you want to get him out, you have to push him into the trap farther in order to defuse the spring. And the dog has to trust you because it looks as if you're doing him harm. So it is at least believable that God is trustable, and we don't know what he's doing in particular, although we do in general. Love's word, after all, is always trust me. Romeo doesn't propose to Juliet in syllogisms, and he doesn't have a battery of lawyers with him when he proposes. The second argument, the argument from the divine hiddenness, is a fairly easy one to answer, I think. Your principle is right. God, if he's love, wants a personal relationship with all of us, and this is possible only if there's knowledge. You can't love someone that you have no knowledge of. However, when you say most people haven't heard of God yet, I deny that. I deny your minor premise. Listen to the missionaries. They preach to these pagans, and they're amazed by how well the pagans know God. Beneath their superstitions, there is almost always a deep knowledge of God. Well, how much? Can you draw a clear line between accurate theological truth on the one hand and pagan superstition on the other hand? Have we no superstitions, no darknesses? Have they no light? It's a matter of degree. I think the human heart is so designed that you instinctively know God, although in a radically inadequate way. But how much knowledge is necessary for a love relationship? Again, you can't draw the line, but you need at least some, but I think minimal knowledge, because you can love far more than you can know. Your little children love you enormously, but they know you not very well at all. And we can do the same to God. Well, you might ask, why does God hide then? For what purpose? It seems arbitrary. Well, first of all, to elicit our search. And secondly, so that our relationship can be free. Pascal says he gives us just enough light for seekers, and not so much light that it would compel non-seekers, so that those who finally enter into this relationship do so freely, not by force of evidence like the light of the noonday sun, which you can't avoid, but rather in response to those key words, the words of love, trust me. Finally, the idea that there is no such thing as a most perfect being is a confusion between the infinite and the finite. There is indeed no greatest number, because numbers are finite. There is not any such thing as the best of all possible worlds, as Leibniz foolishly thought, because you can always add one more perfection to a finite world. But the idea of God as the most perfect being is not like the highest number or the best possible world. It is the positively infinitely perfect being. So that's just a confusion. I think I've exhausted my 10 minutes, so there are my rebuttal to you. You are now free to rebut me.
Thank you. Now, Dr. Corsi, offer your rebuttal.
Now, I think for this rebuttal, I'm just supposed to respond to your arguments and not your objections to my arguments, and then we're going to... Okay. Okay, there's a lot of stuff to talk about. Okay, 12 arguments. Well, one thing that, before we get to that, Dr. Creep said atheism, I believe, if I heard correctly, atheism is a kind of faith. Kind of faith, yeah. I don't think that's true. I think there are, certainly there are people that are a bit fanatical about atheism. There are also people that just don't really care one way or the other. and they look at the reasons and they don't seem that good, I don't see that as being a kind of faith. I don't think everything amounts to faith. I think reasons are relevant. And the reason I think reasons are important is that they're the only way to discover the truth. A blind, irrational faith is like taking blind guesses. If that's all we've got to offer you, atheists or theists, you've got nothing here of any interest. Right? It's the reasons I think that matter. And so let's get to them. 12 arguments, starting with Aquinas' arguments. Argument from motion, argument from first cause are very similar, so I'm going to group them together. One thing to point out here is that, well, suppose there is a first mover. Suppose there is a big banger, as Dr. Creep cleverly put it. Why think it's God? Why think it's God rather than some other supernatural being? Why not think it's several beings? Why not think that it's some other thing? Why not think it's some other natural process? If you look at Aquinas' argument to try to make that leap, I think you'll find it wanting. I think it's problematic. I don't think showing even that there's a first cause or a first mover is going to show that there's a God. Second, I don't see any reason to believe that the process doesn't continue back before the Big Bang or before the first cause. There may be various other things that happened outside of our universe that resulted in our universe. The fact is, no one knows what caused the Big Bang. Some have theorized it was caused by nothing, quantum physics, vacuum fluctuations, and all this kind of stuff. I don't know if that's true, but it's a possibility. Maybe there's some supernatural causal processes that continue back infinitely. There's no reason offered in this argument to think that they couldn't. Finally, I mean, one portion of these arguments, as Dr. Creef presented them, seems problematic. Dr. Creef, as I recall, said nothing moves itself. Nothing can cause itself. Well, then presumably God can't either. So he would not do as a first cause. So I think even if you were to grant everything that Dr. Creef had said about these in terms of first movers and first causes, there's no reason to believe that it's a God. And I don't think that you should grant even much of the argument as I'm getting tangled up here. I think there's problems with those arguments, as I just said. Okay. Argument from contingency and necessity. Some things are contingent. It doesn't follow that at some point later all things are contingent. It doesn't follow, therefore, that there has to be a non-contingent being. There could simply be contingent beings overlapping back infinitely. Regarding the argument from perfection, there must be an absolute standard for truths. Otherwise, truths are for perfection. Otherwise, perfection is just a fiction. But it seems that there can be truths without there being a perfect being. We don't get our idea of a cup of coffee from a perfect cup of coffee. We can get that without a perfect cup of coffee existing. Presumably the same holds for perfection in general. Regarding the argument from design, common move here. Dr. Creef says, well, on the one hand, it's random chance or it's design. Random chance is ridiculous. That's true. Random chance is a ridiculous supposition for explaining what goes on in the universe. He assumes, therefore, it's got to be design. It doesn't. There's a third option. The third option is that things can be orderly without being designed or random. The laws of nature don't function randomly. If they did, every time you got in your car and turned it on, it would be just as likely to start as it would be to turn into a chicken. That isn't the case. The laws of nature work in a regular way and consequently create orderly phenomena. But it's a mistake to read into anything that's orderly the thought that it must be designed. I think that's just a false dilemma there. Second, even if there is a designer, there's no reason to think that it has to be God. Maybe it's multiple beings or objects or things or processes. Third, I don't know if the design is all that great. I mean, if you were going to design a universe, would you make it for human life, for a life like ours? Would you make it such that almost all of it could not support human life? Would you make parts of it blow up every now and then? I'm not convinced it's such a good design. It's okay. But I think there's room for improvement. The eternity of truth. Certainly there are eternal truths, but there doesn't, it's true that true ideas exist in a mind, but truths can exist without a mind. This is Dr. Creef's sixth argument. Imagine we were all to disappear. Would there still be one sun in the solar system? Yeah. We wouldn't be here to know it, but it'd still be there. Consequently, there can be truths without minds. Consequently, there can be eternal truths without minds. The moral argument that, let's see, we should never disobey our conscience. I don't think that's a very good moral rule. There are people who fly planes into buildings and says, my conscience told me this was the right thing to do. I don't think everyone's conscience works all that well all the time. I think instead you need to go by reasons rather than just by feelings in many cases if you're going to get at the truth. Secondly, and I agree that there are absolute moral truths, if you like, that there are moral truths that are objective. I think moral relativism is about the worst idea anybody ever came up with. What authority is behind all of this? Well, I think there can't be an authority behind morality. If there were, morality would be simply a result of a creature authoritatively commanding things. But then either those commands have reasons behind them, in which case it's not the authority that's creating morality, it's the reasons, or the commands have no reasons behind them. If they have no reasons behind them, they are utterly arbitrary. But morality can't be arbitrary. Morality is a matter of fairness. Treating people arbitrarily is not usually a good way to treat them fairly. Bach's music, therefore God exists. Marilyn Manson's music, therefore there is no God. Okay. The argument from desire. The basic idea is that everything we innately desire must exist. Well, there's a reason that things we innately desire might exist, and that is because we evolved to have these desires. Desires for things like nourishment and food and so forth. I'd even question whether or not I'm not even sure we have those desires. I mean, there's like certain reflexes we have as an infant, but whether they have a concept of nutrition in order to desire it, I kind of doubt that. I don't think that the idea of God is innate in people. There are plenty of people who've never heard of the notion of God. Maybe missionaries go out and they're enthusiastic and say, oh, yeah, that's what we're talking about. That's God. But I think the primitives are going to say, no, that's not what I have in mind. He didn't show up as Jesus and didn't tell us about it for 1,000 years. Our God, you know, our universe came from an egg. It's not coming from this guy. I think you've got radically different ideas here that people can have about God, which suggests that the idea is not innate in any sense. Practical arguments. If atheism is true, then most people are insane. Either people who believe in God and right are right, or they are insane. I think that's, again, a false dilemma. I think there's a third alternative. The third alternative is that humans are fallible. We make mistakes. We're emotional creatures. We respond very strongly to emotions. And I think that these can lead us astray. For example, we all, everybody, me including, atheists too, right, are easily victims of what's known as confirmation bias. We tend to like views, and you're probably noticing this right now, we all tend to like views that come to the conclusion we want and reject and be very critical of views that come to the conclusion we don't like. And this influences our beliefs. When do people become religious? Well, often when they're very young, or they're having an emotional crisis. Either times when they're emotionally vulnerable. This is not going to be everybody, of course, but this is a typical, I think, of how religions and various other views get generated. So I think the claim that either people are right or they're insane is a mistake. I think it's a bit crude. People are people and they make mistakes. We make a lot of them. We make them very easily. Read a critical thinking textbook, you'll discover this, right? And I think those are the mistakes that people have made over time. Pascal's wager. It's to our benefit. Why don't we bet that there is a God? Well, first of all, there's going to be lots of gods out there. Maybe the God that really exists is the one that's going to send you to eternity and hell unless you commit Hare Kerry within 3 minutes of hearing of Pascal's wager. There may be a God that doesn't send people to hell for not believing him. Maybe there are gods that send you to hell for believing in the Christian God. It's not 2 lottery tickets on the table, it's 1 million of them. Right? one bet is probably as good as another. I would suggest if you got at least a decent God, you don't have to make that bet at all. He probably wouldn't want you to.
Thank you, Dr. Corsi. If it's all right with both of you, we're going to allow 5 more minutes to rebut the rebuttals before going into your asking questions. Is that okay? All right. Starting again with Dr. Crave.
Whether atheism is a faith or not depends on which is the default position. And I'm kind of surprised that you didn't argue that agnosticism is the default position rather than atheism. What do we know anyway? The problem with agnosticism is that that really gets refuted by Pascal's wager. There's no chance of winning if you don't either say yes or no. I think the most fundamental philosophical question about the arguments is when comes out when you ask, why isn't the Big Banger or the first cause something other than God? Let's call it Oscar. Well, if there's a first cause and his name is Oscar, then God is Oscar. You're assuming that we first have to define God before we can prove his existence. I'm assuming the opposite, that a hypothesis is tested by the data. Each argument proves a different attribute of God, design, degrees of perfection, by the common principle of sufficient reason, which I think no sane person disputes. So the structure of the arguments is we have certain data in the cosmos, in ourselves. The God hypothesis is the only one that adequately explains the data. Therefore, there is this kind of being. And gradually, you add some attributes. The argument for contingency still makes sense to me. The story of a Native American boy asking his father, who's very wise, what does the world rest on? And father says, a giant turtle. The next day the boy said, what does the giant turtle rest on? And father said, that's a good question, son. It rests on a giant alligator. And the next day the boy says, and what does the alligator rest on? And the father said, it's alligators all the way down. But there has to be something to hold up the alligators. You say chance versus design, it's neither. There's a third alternative, the laws of nature, which create orderly phenomena. I think that's a category confusion. Laws don't create anything. They simply describe something. You ask, is the universe well designed? You assume that you could design a somewhat better one. But I'm at least very glad that you think the universe is at least okay. At least we can live in the same universe. Finally, I think you mistake the point of conscience. It's not a feeling. It's an act of reason, an act of insight. The terrorist bombers who followed their conscience followed very badly formed consciences. And one of the things conscience tells you to do is seek the truth and form your conscience, which they didn't do. So their act was a sin against conscience. Finally, the free will and foreknowledge thing is fairly easy to answer. There is no such thing as foreknowledge because God is not a creature in time. He simply knows everything timelessly. So he doesn't push down dominoes and look into crystal balls and tell you what necessarily will happen. He simply watches it happen as it's happening. But that's old stuff. That's in Boethius, one of those medievals. 5 minutes. That's five. You're five.
Okay. Responding here to Dr. Crease's responses to my own arguments regarding the argument from evil. Okay. Dr. Kreeft first pointed out that God gives us free will, that he doesn't force things upon us. But notice our free will is very limited. We can't make Jupiter disappear by blinking. We can't cause everyone to grow warts by snapping our fingers. Maybe a little more restricted free will would have worked out a little bit better. I think that would be compatible with creating humans the way God would want, and creating less evil as well. What about natural evils, though? I mean, here free will doesn't come into play. Nobody's around to see Bambi suffering the way she does. Dr. Creef says, well, we shouldn't expect to know why God would allow these things. We're like pets to a human owner, or maybe children to a parent. We're not always going to understand the reasons that God has for doing certain things. Well, suppose that's true. Folks fly the planes into the World Trade Center, and they say, God told us to do this. And we say, God wouldn't do that. And they respond, you can't expect to understand his reasons. Right? Well, what's left of morality after we can't understand God's reasons? If God sent an earthquake, maybe he wants these people to suffer. Are we doing the wrong thing by helping them? How could we know? We can't know his reasons on Dr. Creef's view. If we see the child drowning in the ice, well, maybe the child's a brat and God doesn't like him. What are you interfering for? You know, how do you tell? You can't. In order to hold that there are all kinds of things going on in the world, but we can't know whether they're right or wrong, requires us to give up what is probably the most valuable grip we have on the world, which is our moral grip, our moral understanding, our empathy, our compassion for those who suffer and those who need help. Because after all, if this is maybe what God wanted, we can't expect to know one way or the other, maybe we shouldn't interfere. I think to hold that view, you really have to give up on any kind of common sense morality, and I think that's a serious problem. Dr. Creef suggested that maybe natural evils were the result of moral evils and alluded to the Adam and Eve story. I think this is rather implausible. I don't think it's the case that in any sense humans can be held responsible for hurricanes. I think if there was a God, he wouldn't leave it up to one bozo to screw it all up, right? Because you know, right, if you put a switch there and say to a kid, don't touch that switch, you know what's going to happen. And if that switch screws up the entire universe, you're a damn fool for making the switch. So I don't think God would create that kind of scenario. Finally, Dr. Creef suggests we need to trust in God and have faith in God, that these bad things are really ultimately for the best. But again, there you are, confronting the people who organized 9/11. And they say, look, just trust us. Have faith. This is what God wants, right? We know better than that. And we know better because we have a sense of what's right and wrong, and we can apply it. We don't have to cancel it the second it seems to show that God doesn't exist. Regarding the argument from hiddenness, I don't think it's there's any good evidence that it's instinctive that we have any idea of God. I think the better people to listen to are not the missionaries, but the people themselves who say, I don't know what the hell you're talking about when you talk about this. I've got some other ideas going on here. Most perfect being is not like these, but I didn't understand his response to my most perfect being argument. Maybe we can talk about that later. Is agnosticism the default position? I don't know, a whole other issue. Why think the first cause has to be God? Well, it has to be God. Why? Okay. Suppose it's Oscar. Well, why think Oscar is God? I mean, you've got to have some idea of what God is supposed to be. You don't come up with an argument and then say, okay, whatever it is God. You've got to start with the conception of God, or you've got no hypothesis to test to begin with. You don't do the experiment and then formulate your hypothesis. That's data mining. You formulate your hypothesis and then form the experiment. God hypothesis is the only adequate explanation. People, I think, oh, I'm out of time. That was the main point. I'll go and stop there.
All right, now we have an opportunity for you to ask one another questions. And do you want to just take turns asking questions, or does that sound okay? Or all right.
You take morality seriously, and you seem to have good moral principles. It's a personal question, but don't you wish you could ground your good moral principles in a real being who was even more perfectly moral than you?
No. I think that whole notion makes no sense. For the youth of our argument. It makes no sense to talk about morality being grounded in a being. Because if it's, it's commands or something like that, they're going to be arbitrary. Off you go. The argument I presented, I'm sure you're very familiar with.
So you'd rather have a morality that doesn't go all the way up?
I'm not sure what you mean by all the way up.
Has no metaphysical basis.
I think it has a metaphysical basis in the sense that moral truths are ultimately necessary truths, logically necessary.
Okay, so the Platonic idea of the good is your God, your moral superior.
Well, I'm a Platonist, but I'm not Platonic in those respects. Okay. I mean, I'm not, yeah.
So it does,
what I mean?
So it does go all the way up.
Yeah, there's metaphysical, logically necessary truths, if that's what you mean by all the way up, yes.
Okay, but why wouldn't it be better if that's not just an abstract truth, but a quality of a concrete being?
I don't know that it makes any sense for morality to be a quality of a concrete being. I mean, morality consists of a set of logically necessary propositions. How could they be
moral,
part of a being?
Not moral oughts. But moral goodness.
Wouldn't it be better if there's a morally good being, is what you're asking?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's good if there are morally good beings.
Well, okay, this is a psychological question, not a logical question.
Okay.
It's like, wouldn't you wish that your friends were more moral? Wouldn't you wish that the president were a saint? Wouldn't you wish that... everybody in the world were better. Of course you would.
Sure.
Well, then why, by the same principle, don't you at least wish that there were a supernatural being who is the super saint, God?
Well, what for? I mean, why would I want to wish that Santa Claus exists? The world would be richer. I mean,
yes.
Yeah. But that's not, do I really want a world populated by all these supernatural beings
Again, I'm not arguing with you. I'm psychoanalyzing you. Wouldn't you? Did you ever wish you could reasonably believe in God? Did you ever envy the saints?
No.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it always seemed to me that they believe something false.
Yeah.
And I don't envy people for believing something that I think is mistaken.
I guess I was trying to ask, not to be personal or embarrassing, but you seem to be a good philosopher and an intelligent man. I think your reasons are too silly for those for a good philosopher, so I'm wondering what your real reason for atheism is.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think a lot of philosophers would disagree with you, and if you read the literature that they've written on this, you'll see that. So I stand by my arguments. Personally, I don't really care all that much whether or not God exists.
Really?
Yeah. If you could come up with a decent argument that would actually show that, I'd be happy to accept it.
You don't think it's a ridiculous Santa Claus-like superstition that you're morally obliged to divest the foolish universe?
I've started to come to think that, right? But I certainly didn't start off that way. As you get older, you get a little more set in your ways, as I'm sure you're aware.
Yeah, I've been sitting down. You've been wandering around. That's
all
true.
Yeah.
Take it off my butt.
And this is we're so friendly. We're okay. It's okay. But I mean, frankly, I appreciate a good reason. And if someone were to publish tomorrow something in the Journal of Philosophy that really laid it out and laid out a great argument and established that God exists, I would accept it. I don't feel much in the way of personal commitment. one way or the other.
Suppose God came down, performed a miracle, made mm-hmm. Gold letters appear in the sky at 6 o'clock saying, mm-hmm. I am God, ha-ha, all you atheists.
Yeah.
And invited NASA to send up rockets and explore them, and they couldn't explain them, and it was a standing miracle, and then voices came from the letters saying, everything in the Bible is true, I am exactly as such and such believes. What would your reaction be?
Yeah.
No, this is a thought experiment.
I don't. If it said everything in the Bible is true, I would know it was false because I've read a lot of the Bible. It contains self-contradictions. It contains moral falsehoods. So I know there's a problem there. But to get to your point, I mean, if there was something that was generally well tested as a miracle, right? God mm-hmm. coming down and say, "Look, it's me, and I'm going to do these miracles," and I'll do them repeatedly, like he did with the sheep's cloth for Gideon, right? I'm going to do it three times just so you know it's me. And the magicians get full access. It's not an ampule hidden away that no one can open that the miracle is occurring in. It's right out there. I mean, if you have that kind of evidence, right, and any scientist or magician or skeptic could go up and say, okay, prove it, then yeah. You've got good evidence that God exists in that situation.
That would convince your mind, but what would it do to your life?
What would it do to my life? I would want to figure out what this being amounts to, what its intentions are, and go from there.
Suppose it said you have to be a saint.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right? If you really got this God.
Hey, God, you're listening. He's willing. Glad to get that out.
Yeah. How about the reverse, though? Are there any circumstances where you'd be willing to be an atheist? To say, all this is just crazy. It's just Santa Claus all over again. These arguments are terrible, and I just give up.
That's a fair question. Mm-hmm. So, or let's make it even stronger. Suppose I died, and somehow I had consciousness after death, but found out that there was no God.
Okay.
That would be the supreme shock. Mm-hmm. If I found out, let's say, that... my parents weren't my parents, that I was a bastard. That would be a shock.
Mm.
If I found out that my grandfather was Adolf Hitler, that would be an even bigger shock.
Yeah.
If I found out that I was really a Martian, this is planet Earth, isn't it? I'm kind of absent-minded. That would even be a bigger shock.
Mm.
But if I found out that there was no God, I think that would, if not tempt me to suicide, at least... discombobulate my sense of identity, because if God's my creator, I have no more independent identity from him than Hamlet does from Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think you could establish your own identity?
No.
No? Do you think you could, create a purpose for yourself?
I could create artificial purposes, of course. Yeah. I play games.
Yeah.
But
wouldn't
games
take them
get
seriously.
Boring. Games get boring.
Yeah,
and I wouldn't want a boring life after death.
So you would think that all the people that you're dealing with now, the world as it is without God, would just be a complete waste, worthless to you.
No, I'd say the universe would be still pretty okay, but it wouldn't be as great.
Okay. But is there anything? Prior to death, anything now? Where, someone publishes some fantastic argument, we'd say, okay, yeah, I think that's right now. Do you think that could happen?
It could.
Yeah.
We haven't seen all the arguments. We're just beginners.
Yeah.
10,000 years from now, we'll look back in 20th century or 21st century philosophy, and we'll call them the pre-something or others, as we call the pre-Socratics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But having an open mind, though it's essential, is a means to an end.
Yeah.
It's like having an open mouth. It's a means to the end of clamping it shut on something solid that you can eat.
I wonder, though. I mean, for a lot of people, religious belief seems kind of like you were describing it. Life would just be pointless without it. Everything would just be useless. You might as well kill yourself without it. And I wonder, with someone who holds that view, are they really free to accept it or reject it? Is their faith a free faith? If the only alternative to faith is saying life is worthless and I might as well
die. It's most free, precisely because those words, life would be meaningless without this, are the words of lovers.
Mm-hmm.
If you're totally in love with somebody, you would say, they're not just a part of my life. Mm-hmm. They're like my other eye through which I see everything. Mm-hmm. And when they die, it's like the light goes out mm-hmm. on everything, not just a piece of a pie. Mm-hmm. So that's the function that God performs that nothing else can perform mm-hmm. for the whole.
Mm-hmm. So when a spouse dies, might you not instead say, well, you know, they wouldn't want me to be this way. They'd want me to be there for other people.
Yeah, because you're still alive, but you only have one eye, not two. So yeah. You lack that sense of perspective.
Okay. Question?
Okay.
Okay.
But, we better let the audience have a chance.
Sounds good.
All right. So if anyone has any questions that they would like to bring, there's a microphone here, and you can come up to the microphone. This is the only microphone. So if you would like to bring a question, we'll take them as long as we have time. Please be sure that your question is a question and not only a comment. Thank you.
Is it on? Okay, this is for Dr. Atheist. what do you believe happens to you when you die?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Nothing?
Yep.
So you just... nothing. Okay.
That's it. Yep.
One question. Okay. Hi, I'm Scott Broussard, and I'm a philosophy student here, and I have a question for Dr. Kraft. In your 2005 audio series, Faith and Reason, The Philosophy of Religion, you said the following. Atheists certainly aren't stupider than most people. They tend to be smarter, better educated, more logical, and more scientific, and the scientific method is by far the most reliable method we have ever found for finding truth. In fact, it's the only method which has ever succeeded in giving us certainty. If you think the scientific method really is the most reliable method we have ever found for finding truth, and the scientific method consistently refutes supernatural claims, then what role does faith and theism have?
Well, what you quoted was an objection that I went on to answer. I don't think the scientific method...
I've listened to the audio, and it doesn't. No point does it sound like an objection to anything.
I don't believe the scientific method is the only method for finding the truth. I think it is the best method for finding natural truths, but I don't think it is the best method for finding even philosophical truths. And I don't think... that the scientific method can possibly be the only method by which we can find truths, because if it is, it self-contradicts itself, because there's no scientific method that proves that proposition, that the scientific method is the only method for finding certain truths.
I'm Paul, and I was wondering from both of y'all, how is faith a mode of knowing as opposed to reason or rational logic?
Knows you better. A very bright psychiatrist who wants to use you as a case study and interviews you 10 hours a day for a month and writes a 3,000-page book about every in and out of your personality but doesn't care about you. Or your best friend, who's not terribly bright, but loves you dearly and would give their life for you. The deepest kind of personal knowing is love and trust.
Is that what you would define as faith?
Yeah, okay. Faith is trust.
I would say, you know, there are different conceptions of faith that people have. Sometimes they have in mind a completely irrational faith. If that's the case, I think it doesn't provide any knowledge. Some people like Aquinas have in mind a more rational faith that's guided by reason. If your beliefs are guided by reason, I think that's the way to get knowledge.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, I'm Sarah. Dr. Keith, I have a question for you. You say that you don't care if God exists, then why are you standing up here arguing that he doesn't?
Because I think there are good reasons for believing that there is no God. When I say I don't care whether God exists, what I mean is that I don't feel any strong personal commitment one way or the other. But I don't mean to say or suggest that it isn't an important question or worth discussing, right? I'm just saying personally, one way or the other, whatever. But in terms of being a question we should think about, I think it's a great question we should all think about.
I'd actually like to return to Pascal's wager and get a response from either one of you. Houston Smith suggests that there have only been two people in history who were not asked, who are you, but what are you? Jesus and Buddha. And so with regard to this Pascal's wager, I wonder how the Buddha might have responded. And I propose that at least there's a chance he would have seen a lot of value in that less discussed possibility. What if there is no God and I choose to believe there is no God? When Buddha was asked, who are you or what are you? He said, one who is awake. And I propose that if there is no God and I choose to believe there is no God, then I might be one who is awake.
That's self-evidently true. If X is true and you choose to believe X, then you're right, and that makes you more awake. But I think you need a separate Pascal's wager for each religious claim. So the Buddhist could also use Pascal's wager and say that awakeness or enlightenment is so important that it's worth risking anything for. My argument there would be that what you risk for it is ordinary consciousness, which is a real risk, whereas what the Christian risks in trusting God as revealed in Christ is simply his own autonomy as being his own God, and that's a good thing to give away. Although Buddhism is, I think, a consistent philosophy, if I believed it, at least Theravada Buddhism, traditional Buddhism, I would cease to regard the world as a real theater in which real creatures really make choices and have real things to fear and real things to love. And I think that would be a too much of a sacrifice. That would be like kind of a spiritual euthanasia. I would indeed kill the disease of egotism, but only by killing the patient of the ego.
I don't know if all Buddhists would agree with that.
They wouldn't.
There was a statement made about where that the belief that Jesus says that every person will have to make a decision whether or not they believe in him as God or not. And the statement was made, well, if God was all-knowing and all-good, then there would be some souls on the planet that would die and they would have been given a chance. They never were given a chance to know God. And they were, y'all said, well, that doesn't even make sense. I mean, they died. They never got a chance to know this all-loving, all-knowing, all-good God. See, that's my question is, how do you know that once they perish here physically, that their spirit or their soul or their eternal being is not confronted by Jesus? And he says, okay, I didn't, one of my little erroneous beings down there on the planet didn't get to you. But I'm giving you the chance now, okay? See, that's the error in that. I think that I would like to see y'all's response to that point. See, that's what mankind does. They make the mistake of thinking that we know more or we are God. We don't know nothing.
Let him answer.
Very simple answer to that. Very simple answer to that. There are no such creatures on this planet who have no knowledge of God. When Paul preached to the Greeks in Athens, they were pagans, they were polytheists, they were idolaters, they worshipped a lot of gods that didn't exist. Nevertheless, he said to them, there's also this god called the unknown god. I see an altar to him. That altar may have been actually cut by Socrates, who was a stonecutter. And he said, the god you are already worshipping in ignorance, I now declare to you. Now, if Jesus is God incarnate, that means that he is not merely a 33-year-long, 6-foot-high Jewish carpenter who revealed himself to a few hundred people, but is rather the Logos, the mind of God, the light that enlightens everyone who comes into the world.
So everyone has a knowledge of God, however obscure. And God, if he's just, will judge us by the light we have, not by the light that we don't have.
In response to the question, on one standard Christian view, the whole point of life on earth is to come to know and worship God. And so if you accept that view, then waiting until you die kind of misses the point of life on earth. Now, maybe you don't, and so that's where my argument is directed. Maybe you don't accept that view. Maybe you think that knowing God on earth is not a relevant issue, in which case my argument isn't, you know, going to be relevant to you. I would point out that you know, in assuming that knowing that God is going to reveal himself to you after you die, it's the same thing. I mean, you kind of, I thought, criticized me for assuming to know what God has planned or wants to do, but in the same sentence, you are making suppositions about what God wants or what God plans to do. I think anytime you discuss the issue of God, that's inevitable. It's not a question of whether or not you're going to try to understand the mind of God. It's a question of, you know, what sort of understanding are you going to come to with regard to these issues?
Dr. Kraft, in your 11th argument in your presentation opening up, you implied that moral wisdom is derived independently from rational thought, from the human heart, you said. And I wondered why the foundations are mutually exclusive.
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question? I said that moral wisdom is arrived at how?
You get it from the human heart instead of rational thought.
Not instead of. Together with. But without both the heart and the head working together, I don't think you have wisdom. Wisdom is not just a feeling of the heart. Wisdom is not just a concept of the mind. Wisdom is an integrative virtue that holds all of you together.
Okay, thank you.
I'm an atheist, and I read the Bible quite often, but I'm also an ardent student of biblical history. And I wanted to know, are you familiar with any of the historical and archaeological arguments against the existence of God, that there is good historical and archaeological evidence that suggests
I'd
that
I'd be very
Yahweh.
Interested in that, because for 2,000 years, atheists have been trying to invalidate certain claims of the Bible by archaeology. Christianity is, of all the religions of the world, the most vulnerable to such scientific disproof, but it's never been done, as far as I know.
Well, let's say for Paul, for instance, Paul never met Jesus. He had a vision of him on the road to Damascus.
Right.
Does that really count as proof of Jesus's divinity?
No.
I just don't see that the theology that he developed would be indicative of Jesus if he never really met him.
Well, that's a different issue from archaeology. What archaeological discoveries?
Okay, let's say the city of Jericho. The city of Jericho mm-hmm. was not some great city that had a great wall around it, as is mentioned in the Bible. And
can you prove that it didn't have a wall?
Yes, we can. Actually, archaeologists
there are,
have found it.
There are fossils of the absence of a wall
yes,
somehow?
Yes, archaeologists, no. Archaeologists have uncovered Jericho and have found mm-hmm. that there was no great wall. Like, a lot of claims of the Bible are simply not true. They're fictitious. So I can't imagine you can say God exists if the book that is supposed to be written and inspired by him is, quite frankly, a lot of contradictions. I just don't understand that.
So you're arguing that Jericho couldn't have had walls because it was too small?
No, it was a small, semi-nomadic community of farmers. They had a central structure of houses around it, but there was no great wall that was uncovered in any of the excavations, and they've excavated it back to about 2500 BC. I don't, like, there are a lot of claims like this in the Bible, but they're fictitious. They're made up. Like, how can you say that God exists?
Well, I'm not.
That he is.
This interests me because here we have hard data.
There's a lot of it, actually.
I'm not a fundamentalist, so I'd be willing to open my mind to the hypothesis that there are mistakes in the Bible's text in copying numbers, letters, cities, etc. That, it seems to me, is not part of the essential claim of the Bible.
if Jericho was really called Ur, or if it was really a slightly smaller city than we thought, does that really disprove the existence of God? That's a bit of a stretch.
Well, you also say that. Oh, I'm sorry. You also say that God is all powerful and all good, but he does some pretty terrible things in the Bible, and I just don't understand how you can support that.
Really. Read the Chronicles of Narnia. Aslan is also a terrible lion, but he's good.
I would like to know if you believe in justice or not, and if you believe. If you believe in that, how is it going to be maintained without existence of God, a just God? I would like to know if you believe in justice.
Or, yes.
And if you believe in that, how is it going to be maintained without existence of God, a just God?
You mean how are we going to be sure everyone gets what they deserve?
Yes.
We won't.
So there is no justice in this world?
I think there is some justice, and it gets meted out by the court system occasionally. We mete it out to each other.
So what if I don't have the power that I get my right? Who is going to get that for me?
Who's going to violate your rights?
For example, if the president of the America killed my brother, how am I going to get my right?
You probably
don't have that power.
You probably won't. Unfortunately.
So there is no just in this world?
There's some justice, but there's no guarantee it's going to happen. People get away with bad things all the time. And that's, I think, a fact of life.
Wouldn't you wish that weren't so, though? Yeah. Don't you wish there were a God?
I want the real world over wishful thinking.
My name is Huvala Fongo. I'm an electrical and computer engineering student. I have a question for Dr. Cross. Dr. Cross, okay. Doctor, I want to find out from you. Do you know that all that we see, all that we can feel, all that you can feel with your senses, your five senses, all you can reason, you know, do you know that all you see is not all that there is? It's not all there is?
Oh, sure. I haven't looked under the table, and I'm sure there's stuff under there.
Okay. Okay, because, you know, from your argument, from the atheistic, you know, points of view, they try to explain everything by reason, you know, like everything has to get a reason. And when atheism or science doesn't get a reason for what they're trying to prove or disprove, they go dumb. You understand what I'm saying? They go dumb, and they now come into reason, you know, and say maybe some processes formed it this way. And they try to discredit faith. You understand? But in the book of Hebrews, that in the Bible says, it tells us that by faith we understand that the world was framed by the word of God, such that the things which are seen were not made out of things which do appear. You understand? So we, you know, there is no way we can understand God by reason. It happens by faith, you know, by faith we understand the things by faith. Okay. You know, we do understand by faith, you know, but atheism, you know, tries to disprove with reason. You understand? It tries to disprove with reason. And okay, they try to, you know, use the senses to disprove God, you know, but God is a spirit, and we all know that there is a spirit realm, you know, as well as there is a realm of things you can't see. You understand? There are things that you don't see which do exist. So Christianity based its beliefs, its facts, on the realm of the spirit, which only operates by faith.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay.
In response?
This on. I don't know if there's really a question there, but the thought seems to be that we should just forget about reason and believe things on faith. And there are lots of people in the world who believe that. What worries me is, as you've probably guessed, some of them fly planes into buildings. Some of them go kill the infidels. Some of them torture their enemies, et cetera, et cetera. I think the key thing that worries me about faith is that it's arbitrary. It's a very strong feeling attached to no reasons at all. And that's the definition of a loose cannon. And I think not only is it important to stick with reasons, I think it's morally irresponsible to ignore them in preference to faith. Because if you want to treat people fairly, you've got to take into account the facts of their situation. You've got to take into account, if you're in a court case, what really happened, not just have faith that they're guilty or innocent. You should pay attention to the facts. And that's the only way, I think, that you can fulfill your obligations to other people. And so I think the appeal to faith is essentially an appeal to believe whatever it is you want to believe, regardless of whether it's true or false, regardless of whether it's for God or against God. On some views, you can have faith that there is no God. Why choose one faith over the other? And the only way to sensibly start answering questions like that, I think, is to start thinking about reasons. And I think we owe it to each other to do that.
This is worthwhile.
This question is directed to Dr. Corsi, but I welcome Dr. Kreft's comments as well. You mentioned many people come to believe in God either in their youth or through some sort of crisis. In recent years, Dr. Anthony Flew has become and converted to deism, and he is a renowned and respected atheist. I was wondering, are you familiar with his current argument, and would you like to respond to it?
Yeah, Dr. Flew, if you don't know, is a very famous 20th century philosopher. He's been around for a long time. Had been a lifelong atheist. I think he's in his 90s now. I don't know how old he is. 80s. Decided that the version of the argument from design called the fine-tuning argument was a good argument for the existence of God. I would say that I think that argument is a very flawed argument. I think the probabilities that get presented there are misleading. I think they misrepresent the actual odds of getting a universe like ours with the cosmological constants, et cetera, et cetera. And along with other common flaws that are assigned to the argument from design, such as, well, even if there's a designer, how do you know that it's God, et cetera, et cetera, some of the things I talked about. So I think that the reason that he had for switching was a bad one. But I do respect his being open-minded, and I think it would be great if everyone were that open-minded.
I always regarded Anthony Flew as the most intelligent atheist in the world, and I love debates, but I would never debate Anthony Flew. I often said I'll debate any atheist in the world except Anthony Flew. He would knock me down. The fact that he was intelligent enough to convert to theism simply confirms the fact that reason is on my side.
All right. I would like to say that I agree with many of my opponent's principles, especially the principle of open-mindedness and the need always to click your reason in, at least as a judge, as a censor. I also fully agree that a faith that it does not open itself to reason is a very dangerous thing. I am not here to argue for faith as such. I am here to argue for God and faith in God. Which God? The God who revealed himself as the good God, the loving God, the God who is on our side. Although this involves a trust which always goes beyond logical proof, it's not a blind date. It's a marriage based on experience. When Romeo says to Juliet, elope with me, Juliet's not a stranger. She already knows him well enough to be able to say yes or no. Reason then can lead you to the point where the choice is a responsible and free and rational choice, but it could still go either way. So I'm hoping that my opponent, at least sometime between today and the day he becomes as old and as wise as Anthony Flew, makes the opposite and more reasonable choice.
Well, I can do you one better. As soon as I hear the best, the good argument, I'll switch then. I don't necessarily have to be that old, hopefully. You know, in the debate here, we've gone through a lot of different arguments, and a bit superficially, as you might suspect. I'd encourage you, if you're interested in these sorts of issues, to look into them further. There's all kinds of literature on these. If you get any kind of introduction to philosophy of religion textbook, it'll talk about the various arguments, many of the arguments that we've talked about, and go into them in more detail. If you're interested in the historicity of the Bible, as the gentleman was saying, there's all kinds of books out there about these. One I particularly like is called The Unauthorized Version by Robin Lane Fox. There's another author I like is E.P. Sanders. These guys tend to have rather liberal views. I'm sure Peter Kreef can suggest some counterbalancing books. But I think the key thing is you know, even if God is the God you believe that the God you believe in is perfect, humans certainly aren't. And it's certainly always worthwhile to keep an open mind and to look at all sides of a view. And even if you're decided you're not going to change your mind, at least try to understand different points of view. I think people get a lot out of that. Appeals to, well, it says so in the Bible that we should kill homosexuals, so let's do it, or, you know, some people say these things, I'm sure you guys don't, or let's just believe on the basis of faith and not think about it, or stop asking questions, you're questioning God. I think in doing that, you really deprive yourself of a great deal of the richness of life, and of course, I believe life is relatively short, so I wouldn't waste it. Again, you know, I think the important things are the reasons that we have. And look for the best ones and make your best judgment.